So that's one of the things which even the Sangha learns on this retreat, a little bit of confidence, a little bit of relaxation, taking it easy, because even when you're teaching, if you get tense and worry about what other people think about you, now that is just one's ego, one's sense of self, and that causes the anxiety, which means you tend to fail. It's the same with the meditation you do here. If you can just relax and let it happen and don't worry about what people think of you, don't worry about the report cards, which we'll give out later on this morning. I've given you reports on what you did in the meditation. So an A, B, C, D, E, or F. Which one do you think you're going to get? So when you have report cards, that does make you tense. When you have to achieve something, it does make you anxious. But when you are just respected for who you are, and you respect yourself for who you are, and then you can just really let things be, then your meditation gets very peaceful and you're very successful, just like monks and nuns giving talks. You just relax and just have fun, and you find you do a very, very good job. So that was the little lesson for the monks in how to meditate, and the nuns how to meditate last night. Just to do it and just don't think about it. And this is the sorts of things which you learn here. Obviously, there's a big question in front of me here which they didn't answer last night because it pertains to always the last talk. Is, now, how do you take what you've learned here into the outside world? And please don't call it the real life. This is the real life. Look at all the fake stuff you do out there. Sometimes people, monks, why did you get in the real life? Get a real life. We don't have false breasts. We don't have wigs. We don't have makeup. We don't have all this false stuff, you know, which makes people appear to be what they're not. You know, these monks and nuns, this is how we are, and we don't have any extras there to try and deceive reality. And so, if anything is a real life, this is a real life. When what you see is what you get. So welcome to the real life, and when you go out into that false, crazy, artificial world out there, please remember where the real world truly is. And so what happens is when you go back home, that you do learn so much of the attitudes which work in meditation also work in your real world. And it's a great thing to understand that, and you'll find it does work. You'll find that having come here on an 8-9 day retreat, it doesn't matter whether you've got jhana or not, whether you got enlightened or not, you do become a more peaceful or wiser, more kind human being. And that's a wonderful thing to have in this life. And what people don't expect, you actually do become far more productive and successful in whatever career, you know, you want to do. And there was, I've always got these stories. This particular story, I tried to check it up, you know, the details. I remember seeing it, reading it in the Sydney Morning Herald, but I just tried to check it on the internet and just couldn't really get the details. But as I remember it, it was the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney. And the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, the New South Wales government had chaplains from all the major religions inside the Olympic Village to look after the athletes and their families. And it was obviously a high-stress situation for many athletes and their families, and they were all different types of religions, and they wanted their imams, their rabbis, their priests, and also a monk to look after the Buddhists. So this one monk who was in the village, you know, just being of service to anyone who wanted to talk to him. And the article which was written in the Sydney Morning Herald, which I saw, was of the story when an athlete and her two parents came to see him. And I think they were from Russia, the Russian Federation. And what had happened, that she had got herself into the final of one of the track events. I thought it was the 800 meters, but I'm not quite sure. So she was in the Olympic final, and she'd never expected to do so well. And if you've ever been anxious, imagine that. You are going to run in an Olympic final, a track event, not just in front of your mum and dad and your friends, but in front of the whole population of the country where you belong, in front of the TV cameras of the world. Now that was really high stress, and her parents dragged her to see the monk. Not because they were Buddhists, because everybody knows that the experts on meditation are the Buddhist monks. Now we invented it. So they took their daughter to see the monk, because the daughter wasn't sleeping at night. No, because she was too anxious and worried about the final. Nor was she able to relax enough to train properly. So she was just a mess. And in a couple of days, she would have to race in the final. So they took her to the monk, and the monk taught her a very simple form of meditation, just like what we've been teaching you here. And because the monks don't watch the TV, he didn't know what happened. They were just doing whatever he was doing in the Olympic Village. And he didn't know the result until the family came to see him. There's a wonderful description, a personal description, of what happened when he saw in the distance, you know, this family walking towards him. The mother and the father and the athlete in between. And as they came, he recognized it was that family. And as they came closer, he noticed they were smiling. Oh, they must have done well. And the next thing he noticed, being a simple monk, he was, what he described, the athlete in the middle was swinging something on the end of a string. He called it a string. And it's only when they came closer, he saw the colour of the medal, which was gold. And the athlete and the parents had come to thank this monk for teaching them enough meditation to calm the mind, to perform way beyond her expectations and win an Olympic gold medal. Now that's, you know, right there in the top of the league with attainments and with beating your personal best in high stress situation. She did that and they came to thank the monk. I always wish I'd have kept that article, you know, so I could get the details correctly, but that was roughly the details. It was a gold medal, it was an East European athlete, and it was the monk who taught her how to relax. So if you learn, you know, meditation here, you'd be able to represent Bangladesh in the Brazil Olympics. And you could win the 100 meters. Young lady, you could represent Sri Lanka in the high jump. I get a gold medal. Prashant, you can get the gold for India in the marathon or whatever you want to do. But it is true that the power of meditation, it does really give you more power. I mean, whatever you have to do in life. So how can you do this? And of course, you know that I like to talk in stories. There are two stories which I'm going to share with you. They're old stories, but they're very powerful with how you use what you learned here in your daily life, in the artificial world outside. And number one was a story which sometimes I teach this to people. It's a very old and well-known story, which helps them in their daily life. I teach it in business schools, but I should have really taught it in your meditation, because in the meditation it's incredibly effective. Because you know how complicated meditation can be. You've had so many instructions. Think, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to watch the breath? Am I supposed to let go? Am I supposed to do this? And sometimes when you keep it nice and simple, you have far greater depth in meditation. This instruction is wonderful for meditation and wonderful for life. You can use it for anything. And it's the old Emperor's Three Questions story. The Emperor, the Tolstoy story, the Emperor wanted to find his own religion because he was fed up with all the other religions, always arguing with each other, always saying that my religion is the best, my part of Buddhism is the best, my part of this tradition of Buddhism is the best, and yours isn't. And because of all of that, you know, many people, they get very discouraged with religions, always arguing with each other. So in this story, the emperor wanted to find his own religion. And eventually he realized there's only three questions you need to know the answers for in life. Nothing to do with the origin of the universe or creator or the soul or anything else. The most important questions, he said, the practical ones, is when is the most important time, who is the most important person, and what's the most important thing to do? And you probably all know that story. The most important time is now. But we forget the answer to that question. How many of you have already packed your bags? What have you done that for? You haven't left yet. We may make the announcement. Maybe it's a good time to make this announcement. That, you know, because many of you have had really good meditation, some of you are very close to nimittas. You've got a couple of them, but they're not really strong yet. Some of you got big nimittas and are close to jhanas. Other you, if you, another day or two, you may even get enlightened. So with Dania's with the Dania and Bianca's approval, this retreat is extended for another week. So please unpack your bags. You're not eating again this evening. Well, that could happen. So, isn't it the case we mess up so much of our life when we're way ahead of ourselves? We pack our bags before we've left, and our mind is already back in the restaurant this evening. Already thinking, planning what we're going to eat tonight. So, isn't that a great shame that you're sort of, you know, throwing away hours, days, weeks, sometimes years of your life, waiting for something to happen in the future? So it really is important. Now is the most important time, even in business. Don't wait till the next moment. In your business, right now, this is where the action is. And the most important person, you know the answer to this question. It always shocked me when I first understood this. It was a powerful, great insight. The most important person is the one right in front of you. So what is the most important meditation object? Is it nimittas, more important? Is it the breath? Is it the body? Is it the jhanas? What's the most important meditation object? Exactly, the one which is right in front of you right now. Whatever that is, that's always more important than anything else. So even if you have dullness, that is the most important meditation object for you. Why? Because it's right in front of you. When you're in business, you're talking to a client. Who is the most important person? That client right in front of you. That supplier, that person asking all these stupid questions. They're the most important person in the whole world. When you go home and you're with your wife, who's the most important person? If the wife is right in front of you, she is the most important person. How often? I'll talk to you later, darling. How does that feel? So the one in front of you does become the most important person. And then last thing, what's the most important thing to do in life? Because sometimes we ask that question in business. Is it to make money? Is it to make sure that the business prospers? Or is it to, you know, to look after our workers, look after our partners, be kind to them? Sometimes that's a great paradox in business. You know, should I just worry just about the bottom line, or should I be caring for all the people who are working for me? You know, what should I do in business? You know, what should I do as a monk who's in charge of a monastery? How should I run that monastery? How should we run a retreat? How did Bianca look after you as a manager in this retreat? The most important thing, and the reason why I heard you clapping in there and saying three big sadhus, is because Bianca cared for you. To care is the most important thing in the world to do. So there we have some very, very simple answers, which are, at first you think is obvious, but when you really reflect upon them, not only do they empower your meditation, they just give you so much success in life. Now is the most important time. Whoever you are with is the most important person. If you're with whatever mind state, that's really important to you. If you're with an ache or pain in the body, if that's right there in front of you, that's important. Don't try and get rid of it. The thing to do with it is to care for it. And if you understand that, you'll understand how to meditate and how to be successful in life. I am a very deep, powerful meditator, but look at what we've created here in West Australia. Incredible nuns' monastery, a big monks' monastery, a great jhana grove. And how did that happen? By caring for people. By people in front of you. Make sure they're important. And now is the most important time. Forget about the future. Now is where the future is being made. And that's such a powerful little teaching, so simple. I love repeating it and emphasizing that could be just the three principles of your life. Or if you have a company, that can be the company ethos. And that will create so much success. Not just bottom line success, but the success in creating, you know, happy, successful, healthy human beings. So this is something which you can remember when you go back. Now is the most important time. So please, when you go to the airport, because many of you are flying all over the place, please don't wait for the plane to go. You have half an hour, 45 minutes, sitting in the terminal or whatever. Don't just kill time. We don't kill anything in Buddhism. That's against our first precept. So instead, just sit down and meditate in the airport, or read a book, or listen to something important. Don't waste the opportunities you have in life. At the very least, just relax. Because now is the most important time. Who knows, you know, you're at flight this afternoon or tomorrow, could be the next MH370. It does happen, you know. Are you scared that might happen? No, you're going to die somewhat time. And that's a great way of dying. You know, I kept on saying that the three benefits of dying in an aircraft explosion at 36,000 feet. Because sometimes that happens. You know, bombs go off in the aircraft. And sooner or later it's going to happen again. And so what do you do? Imagine just how wonderful that is to die in an aircraft explosion at 36,000 feet. For three reasons. The first is, it's an instant cremation. It's done on the spot. You don't have to just arrange the funeral directors and the feed of, in Asia you have to feed all your friends. Not just your friends, these other people walk in, you don't know who the hell they are, but they still, you know, get some food from you. It costs you a fortune. It took days and days just to arrange this. If it dies in an aircraft, it's done on the spot, immediately the family have nothing to organize. And even the ashes are scattered for you. And number two, how expensive are funerals? They're very expensive, especially in Malaysia and Singapore. You have to get those ashes and you have to put them in some sort of place of respect. And it's very difficult because that's your mother, your father, and you've got to put them in a nice place. But the nicer place on the top of the stupa, I mean, that really costs an arm and a leg. That costs a fortune. And so it's a great sort of tussle for the family. You know, this is our father, our mother, can we afford it? But it's with our mother, it's the only one we've got. And so it ruins the whole family. No, disposing of the ashes, but here, in an aircraft explosion, not only do the family not have to pay anything at all for the funeral, the family get money back. It's true, because the aircraft company, they have to pay compensation. So financially, the bottom line is really wonderful for the family instead of ruining it. And of course, you know the last one, the best thing about dying at 36,000 feet in an aircraft explosion is you are so close to heaven. It's so easy to go the rest of the way. So this is where you don't worry about anything. You always keep this beautiful positive mind, which hopefully you've heard in this meditation and this retreat. And also, have you noticed something? For those of you who come on the interviews, sometimes you've messed around. You know, a couple of you confessed having noodles in the evening in your hut. I know only a couple have confessed, but I know many more people. And you mean, sometimes you mess around and stuff. Have I ever criticized any of you? Have I told any of you off? Have I scolded you and said, do that one more time and you're out of here? But instead, every time you've come in there and you've told me something, you may have noticed I only say, very good. I got so well known for that, that many of the monks in Bodhinyana Monastery said, oh, we can teach retreats as well. And the interviewers always do, we sit there, we say, very good. And they say, you know, I've been sleeping all day, very good. I was using my mobile phone to check the stock market, very good. Now, the reason I say that is, again, it's really important because that's how I want you to do your meditation and do your life. Whatever happens to you in life, very good. Because it really just depends on your attitude towards your meditation, your attitude towards life. It's exactly the same. You know, you can make this huge problem out of the things which happen to you in life. You've got cancers. Somebody dies in your family. If you listen carefully to what I say, then I say, very good. Even just last night, somebody, an old friend, came and his wife of 55 years passed away 4 months ago. 55 years they'd been married, and now she's dead. And he was a bit sad in front of me, and I said, your wife's died. Very good. And I said, very good that you've had 55 years together. What a great blessing that was. You haven't lost your wife. You gained her for all those wonderful years. And afterwards he said, yeah, thank you. So you can see just how you have the choice there to look upon the death of someone you've known for such a long time, 55 years, and now they're dead, and they're not with you anymore. You can look upon that as very good. Look upon the positive part of that experience, 55 years together. Wow. Or you can look on the negative side of it. You know, they're not there anymore. What am I going to do? Oh, this is terrible. It's the same with meditation. If you develop what we call fault-finding mind, you're never good enough in meditation. You can never relax. There's always something to fix up. You don't have this beautiful opening the door of your heart to this moment, no matter what it is. Have you experienced that when you have fault-finding mind in meditation, you can never find peace? There's always something more to do. Oh, I've only got first jhana, I want second jhana. Oh, I've only got the first stage of enlightenment, I want full enlightenment. Oh, I've only got full enlightenment, I want psychic powers. There's always something more you can want. But that's a problem. It's when we want something more, remember, you can't enjoy what you already have. And it's the same in just many parts of life. You know, when we want something more, we can't really put all our attention into what's happening right now. We can't really be here and enjoy this moment and make the most out of it. We're always somewhere else when life is actually happening. So when we can understand that, we can understand just how, you know, living our life and being successful. If that lady who won the Olympic gold, if she didn't know how to be in the present moment, to relax, to prepare her body, prepare her mind by just not worrying about what's going to happen next. Worrying about what's happening now is more important. And then she actually won the medal. That man who just, his wife died 4 months ago. If he thought of all the terrible things, you know, that had been taken away from him, instead of remembering all the wonderful things he had, he'd get very depressed and very unhappy. So we have that choice in life. It's just an attitude. Which is also one of the reasons why I said in this meditation, I said this yesterday, it doesn't matter what you're experiencing in meditation. What really matters is how you experience it. The attitude you have to whatever you're having to deal with. Because you can't choose all that many things in life. Sometimes you have energy, sometimes you're tired. Sometimes the mind is very bright and still, sometimes it's restless. And that's nature. Sometimes you're healthy, sometimes you're sick, sometimes your business goes really well, sometimes it's difficult. That's the nature of these things. But what separates a successful business person, a successful human being, a successful meditator from one who's not successful is how they deal with those difficulties in the meditation, how they deal with the difficulties in life, where they can not find fault with it, but make use of it. And this is actually how we make use of anything in life. My story, which I keep on repeating, but it's again another powerful one, you know, sometimes bad things happen to you in life. Sometimes bad things happen to you in the meditation. You have a terrible meditation, so you think. But I was taught by my first teacher, there is no such thing as a bad meditation. Even the meditations which are difficult, you learn so much from them if you've got right attitude. And it's the story of treading in the dog shit. As long as you don't scrape the dog shit off your shoes, never ever do that. Always take it home with you, and only to scrape it off when you get into your garden. And scrape it off under the mango tree 1 year later, because you took the shit home with you and put it in the right place. 1 year later, your mangoes will be sweeter and juicier than ever before. And you must always remember, when you're eating the juicy sweet mango, what you're really eating. What are you eating? It's dog shit. But it's transformed into really sweet, juicy mango. It's how you make use of these things. And so all the difficult meditations you think you may have had, that's all dog shit for the wisdom and the compassion which make up your eventual enlightenment. You are growing the Bodhi tree. As long as you dig it in. And don't keep it. Dig it in. So once you've learned how to dig in sort of the difficulties in life, you realize that's where your successes come from the difficulties. Now, of course, at this time of the meditation retreat, people start thinking, oh, I haven't got anywhere in this retreat. This is really terrible. I've done all this work and got nothing out of it. Yes, you have. But the paycheck may have not arrived yet. Because I developed a simile when people say, why is it I've been meditating day in, day out, and still nothing has happened to you? Other people have got nimittas, but not me. And I tell them to wait. And I gave them the simile of the man who went to work, a migrant to Australia. And he went to work on Monday at a building site, the only job he could get. He worked really hard. And at the end of the day, when he went home, his wife told him, how much did you earn? He said, nothing, I didn't get paid at all. He went there the next day, worked really hard, and again, never got a cent. And on Wednesday, he was, you know, thinking, what's the point of going? We went there anyway. And when on Wednesday he still hadn't got paid, he went back to his wife and said, I'm not going to work anymore. Waste of time in Australia. They don't pay you anything. You work really hard, you get nothing out of it. But, you know, he didn't have anything else to do, and his wife was pushing him. So he went to work on Thursday. Same thing happened again. Nothing, working all day. And he didn't really want to go to work on Friday, but, you know, he went anyway. And midway through the afternoon on Friday, the boss gave him a big pay packet. And when he went back home, he told his wife, I finally understood how things work in Australia. From now on, I'm not going to work on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I'm only going to go to work on Fridays. And of course, I tell that story because, you know, you think it's stupid. But how many of you are like that? You meditate, I've got paid. I'm not going to do this retreat anymore. Now I get nothing out of it. I'm not going to go anymore. And then you get a good meditation. I'm only going to meditate, you know, when I get good meditation, when I get the pay packet. You eventually get the pay packet, but all the pay packet which you get, the beautiful, peaceful, wonderful meditations, which you must eventually get, that is the result of all the other meditations you did, which you thought were useless. They're not useless. All the times you get a lot of happiness in life. A lot of times that's what you've been doing when you've gone through the difficult parts of life. You get the pay packet eventually. But sometimes it takes a while. So don't get disappointed if you meditate and you haven't got jhanas yet. Don't worry. the check is in the mail. I did read in a newspaper there was one letter in Canada. It took 46 years before it got delivered. But don't worry, it is in the mail somewhere. So anyway, so you have a beautiful attitude and eventually these things happen. It has to be cause and effect, that's the only way. And for me as a teacher, it's great to see people meditating year in, year out, and see little by little they get more peaceful, more calm, and just to see the great results it has on their health and on their emotional well-being and, of course, on their spiritual well-being. Sometimes I can't really tell much difference between those three. Now, because the more you progress on the path towards enlightenment, the more healthy you get, and just basically the more at ease you get. Emotionally, you become much more balanced. So, you know, the health, emotional balance, the spiritual progress, they all go together. It's all the same thing. So it's wonderful to see that. So sometimes people come and they come to meditate because they're in ill health. They want to learn meditation to overcome cancers or other diseases which they have. And little by little, just, yeah, you know, those diseases go, but they also get so much insight. They get closer towards enlightenment. They get closer towards everything. And just emotionally become much more settled human beings. So it's the path is just for everything. So that's again why I say, you know, well, you know, what do we do when we go home? When you go home, you just carry on. You've got no choice. For the last 8 or 9 days, you have been brainwashed by me. I'm sorry, you've got no choice anymore. I've got into your heads and I will control you from a distance. So you will meditate. And the most important thing is when you do meditation at home, please find happiness in it, enjoy in it. It's one of the reasons why people don't meditate enough, because you know they don't enjoy it. It's not fun. Oh, it's something I have to do. I've got to get up in my morning. I do my meditation, I do my exercise, I brush my teeth, but you don't enjoy it, you just do it as some sort of penance. So please, meditation should never be a penance, it should always be done with the wisdom and happiness, realizing just how peaceful and calm you can become. And when I started meditating, still as a student, a lay person, you know, after the first 1 or 2 years, I really got into it for the first 1 or 2 years, then after about 3 years, I started to fade away. I wasn't so interested anymore. And I always remember this one French guy who actually put me back on track. I don't know who he was, don't know his name, lost contact with him. I was having a cup of coffee with him one day, just, I forget even where it was. You know, you're just young people, you just sit down and talk to each other, total strangers. But he was meditating, I was meditating, and he said, "How are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm not getting much out of it these days." And he gave me this wonderful piece of advice, which, you know, basically made me the meditator I am today. And it's so important for me. He said, "Look, all your meditations are good meditations, only you're not realizing it." And he asked me, at the end of every meditation, "Can you just pause and just reflect on how the meditation has changed you? From the beginning, when you started meditating, to when you finished, can you notice any change?" And I took him at his word, I followed that advice, and even those meditations I thought were bad meditations. I never got jhanas or nimittas or anything, but even the ones I thought were bad meditations, I still got a lot of progress. I was far more peaceful at the end of the half an hour than I was when I started. And that really gave me a lot of encouragement. It gave me feedback. It was actually working. It was not a waste of time. And that actually made me always get into that habit at the end of a meditation to ask myself, now how does it feel? And does it feel any better than when you began? And it made a huge amount of difference. What I was doing, I was recognizing what the meditation had done for me. Now all of you here, some of you may think you've had a terrible retreat, it hasn't really got very far. You didn't get jhanas, yeah, but you had a nice peaceful time, but you're just resting and relaxing and sleeping a lot and eating well. But you think that you haven't got much out of this meditation retreat. Wait until you go home. Because that is when you get the best feedback from the people, I say the people who have to put up with you. You will find they are so, so grateful that you've been here for 7, 8, 9 days. And you're so much more peaceful, relaxed, happy. And it shows. Even if you go to your health professional and get a checkup after a retreat, it shows. There's this one monk, he had a high-stress job in the city of Perth, but he was a very good, kind Buddhist, so he'd always go and donate blood every 3 months, I think. And after he became a monk, he went to donate blood again, and I was with him at that time. I was donating blood at the same time. And I was with him when the nurse took his blood pressure and then checked it against the record and said, hey, hang on a moment, your blood pressure has changed. He said, it's really gone down. It's really healthy now. What have you been doing? And before he could answer, you know, she looked up, and she should have noticed this. He was dressed in brown with a bald head. Ah, oh, you're a Buddhist monk. You've been meditating. Ah, that's it. And she never even asked again. Now she knew that through the meditation, your blood pressure goes down. Now everything starts to get much healthier. So you know, if you check, you know, whatever's wrong with you, diabetes, heart problems, Ebola virus, I don't know what you're coming here with. But I guarantee you, you'll be far healthier. You'll be far healthier when you leave than when you came here. Because, you know, these are the benefits of the meditation. And sometimes, you know, you can feel that. As you develop your meditation, your mindfulness increases. You become much more aware. Simply because, remember I said, through stillness, you give energy to your mindfulness, you become far more aware. You don't just become aware of the beautiful sunsets or the beautiful views from China Grove or the wonderful sort of food. You also become aware of your own body. You actually feel it. You can feel parts of it which are stressed out, which are tired. You can actually feel parts of your body. You're much more aware of it. And so because you know where the problems are or what the problems are because of your awareness, you can do something about it. You know the way to deal with the problems in the body, just be kind to them. And I'm just amazed just how the power of kindness, not just in meditation, when I'm kind to the difficulties in my mind, they just vanish. When I'm kind to the sicknesses in my body, they too vanish away. Sickness and happiness, that gets rid of things. I remember just somebody, I forget who they were, but in my tray in Bodhinyana Monastery, there's a whole sheet of stamps from the US government of Jimi Hendrix. Because somebody knew that I liked Jimi Hendrix, and so they now got a stamp issued in his honour. I don't know why, he's a bit of a scallywag, but he could certainly play a guitar. But anyhow, one of the experiences I had as a young student, I was up in the north of England in a college up there, just because my girlfriend was up there. I went up to the town of Durham for 1 year. And I was really sick with a flu, really ill. So, you know, if you had a flu, you can't get out of bed. You feel terrible. You know, all this liquid is running out of your nose. And your eyes are just weeping. And you're always sneezing and coughing. The whole works. So no way was I going to go out to, you know, the lectures that morning. So, you know, all the other people in the house had gone. I was there in the house by myself, feeling really like death. And then somebody rang the doorbell, and I said, go away. And they kept on ringing and ringing, so I got up, staggered out from my bed, and there was a parcel for me. And I realized it was, you know, these are old days before you had, you know, iPods. It was like a hi-fi system. The only way you could play music was about four or five big boxes, you know, two speakers, an amplifier, and a turntable. And it was a hi-fi system I'd sent out from London. This was 1972, I think. And now I could play some records. I could have some fun, enjoy myself. So even though I was sick with a flu, I went up to my room, put the whole thing together, which took about half an hour, and then put on my first vinyl record, which was Jimi Hendrix. And by the time that first track had finished, I was not sneezing anymore. Nothing was coming out of my nose. I wasn't coughing. I had full energy. My flu had totally disappeared. So that's the way to cure flu. And of course, it wasn't sort of the power of Jimi Hendrix. It was just because I was enjoying it. I had a little bit of happiness. Instead of feeling so sorry and sick for myself, which was actually making the flu continue, I took my mind off it, had a bit of happiness, a bit of joy and excitement, and the flu totally vanished. Have you had those experiences before? It's incredible. Just something, it wasn't imagining the flu. That stuff was coming out of your nose and coughing and, you know, eyes watering. It was a real thing. And then suddenly, half an hour later, it was totally vanished. Simply because of some happiness and excitement. That's one of the reasons why you understand how this mind works and how it interferes with the body through this power of meditation. When you get some happiness coming up in the meditation, you get incredibly healthy. Things, I don't know why, bacteria, viruses, they can't stand it. Misery, oh, they love misery. They love negativity. Ugh, the government, climate change, any negativity you may have, you know, that really makes you sick. So that is why just you learn from mindfulness and from three big sadhus. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's totally crazy, but it makes you healthy, so why not? You're learning a lot with the mindfulness, the happiness, the kindness. Those three things going together, part of meditation. And that means that you will like this meditation. You see the benefits of it. And so you don't have to ask me, Ajahn Brahm, when I go back to the artificial world, how much meditation should I do? I ask you, when you go back home, how many meals are you going to eat? Do you actually have to say, oh yeah, okay, I must eat three meals a day. Now I must do this. Okay, now I must, no, it doesn't matter if I don't feel like I'm eating, I've got to do this. Do you have to force yourself to eat? Especially when you're from Malaysia and Singapore. And you don't, do you? You can't stop yourself eating. Even though you're on eight precepts, you can't stop it. You can't do it. I realize that. That's why I don't try to stop you. We just pretend. So imagine it's the same with meditation. Imagine you went on a retreat where you're only allowed to meditate in the mornings. And then you snuck back into your rooms. I'm not allowed to meditate in the afternoons, but I'm going to meditate anyway. No one's going to watch me. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Now that is when you enjoy meditation, that's what happens. So you don't have to sort of ask me, when I go back home, how much should I meditate? When you enjoy it, you can't stop yourself. You see the benefits, you're having good fun, and you're seeing great results in your health, in your business. They're solving problems. That's the other thing which I mentioned, which is really great. Now, I have problems to solve in monasteries and all over Australia, you know, Dhammasala and Santi and all this other stuff which, you know, you have to do and make decisions about. It's endless. You'll never solve all the problems, you know, in life. Well, what I do, I've got this beautiful way of solving problems. I just don't think about it. So you may ask me all these questions, but, you know, that's what I do. I'm honest with you. I don't think about it, and just so either solutions come or just the problem vanishes. It's amazing just how many times I said, oh, maybe no, next week when the retreat's over, I'll give you an answer. And situations have changed. Things have got different, and I don't need to make the decision anymore. Something else has happened. Such a wonderful thing just to procrastinate. You know, people die, people get divorced, you know, nuns leave or whatever, and I don't have to decide anymore. Or something. And if that doesn't happen, the other thing which happens is you get some good ideas when you're not thinking about them. That's a great thing with meditation. When you know how to let go and make your mind peaceful and still, you really are opening up channels of wisdom. Every time you think, you're blocking up the possibility of wisdom. So when I do have to make a decision, I can't get out of it. I just let go, make the mind peaceful. I just wait. sooner or later a good answer comes, and they're really good solutions. That's why these places have been pretty successful, because all the ideas come out of silence. They don't come out of, you know, just what should I do, how should I rebuild Jhana Grove, how can we get money for Dhammasara Monastery, what should we do? You know what you do, you're really silent. You just forget about things, and all these crazy ideas come up, like when we're doing the auctions. You know, so nothing left to auction. So, you know, and then Lee was asking me, what else can we get? She'd already ripped everything out of my cave. Except the rocks. That's So, you know, I needed something more, and so I just was really silent and peaceful. And then just, you know, the idea comes up, solutions come up. Auction me. So I got auctioned. I got sold for 7 days. No one's ever done that before. And these are like innovative solutions. I'm a very innovative monk. And the reason why you're innovative and do really new things is because you have silence. In silence, wisdom comes. Both, you know, wisdom in the sense of understanding the nature of the body and the mind, but also in just the worldly life. Of, you know, how you're going to solve problems, how you're going to settle disputes. All of those answers never come up when you think about them. So if you can develop more silence in your business, in your working life, it's amazing how wise you'll become, how innovative, seeing things in a different way, and how that you can, as they say, get a cutting edge in the cutthroat life of business. You can do things your competitors can't. You can shut up and be still and have these incredible ideas come up. Where they come up from, I don't know, but they certainly come up. And that's actually where you can be very successful in your life. And also the other part of, you know, the artificial life outside, you know, your relationships, you know, husbands, wives, kids and parents. Now, half the time when people come for interviews, they're not talking about meditations or jhanas or nimittas. They're talking about wives or kids or parents, all that sort of stuff, because that's important for you. That's, you know, a great proportion of your life is your family. Not work, you know, not your spiritual, but, you know, your family life. And so it's great when you can learn, you know, from, you know, what you do in meditation, how to get on with somebody else. How can you get on with your in-laws? How can you get on with this man, this lady you've been living with for such a long time? And you have great ideas of how to get on with them. The same way you can get on with your own mind. You've been living with longer than your wife, longer with your husband. But sometimes your wife nags you, but not as much as your mind nags you sometimes. Come on, meditate. Come on, you're stupid. Come on, you should be doing better. Sometimes the one which really nags is the one inside, the mind. And so how do you solve that problem with your mind? You let it be. Lower your expectations. Don't try so hard. Don't have all these goals in meditation. Just let it be. And appreciate the mind as it is. Don't have so many demands of your partner. Don't expect him to always come home on time and remember your anniversaries. You know, that's asking from life what it can't give you. It's not in the man's brain to do such things. When I was in Hong Kong, and because you got such a quiet, peaceful mind, I came up with all these business ideas. And somebody said they were going to do this. It was remindyourboyfriend.com. You know, an app. You know, because boyfriends always forget, you know, when it's, you know, your anniversary or when you've got to come to this event or that event. Boyfriends always keep forgetting. So you can actually give them this app, you know, remind your boyfriend, and, you know, the girlfriend can actually, you know, type in all the reminders for their boyfriend, and it goes on his smartphone and always beeps at the right time. Remember, you've got to sort of pick up some chocolates for me this evening. Whatever. And the people in Hong Kong, wow, that's a good idea. How come you're a monk And you can think of that. I don't know if they've actually done it, but they were going to investigate it. They actually found out that no one's got that subdomain name yet. So I think they may have already booked it. So where do you get all these ideas from? I got the idea, you know, to have, you know, I'm sure it's going to happen, you know, drive-in temples, you know, Mac Buddhas. Mac Buddhas? Because how many people have got time these days to go to temples? You know, we always say this, you know, you get monasteries, you get temples, but look, you have got to adapt to a modern lifestyle. So drive in. So you drive in and you can see the menu in there. First of all, chanting. And then chanting for what? Chanting for, you know, marriage problems, kids, health, what else? Lottery, whatever else people get chanting for. You know, birthdays, deaths, so you can actually press a button, what you want. And then, you know, instead of do you want fries with that, do you want holy water with that? And a little nozzle comes out if you press and squirts you with holy water. And then whatever chanting you want, a little little earpiece comes out, you can listen to whatever chanting you want. Absolutely perfect, you know, don't have to wait. And at the very end, you go to the window and you give your Ang Pao, the donation. Imagine that in Singapore. I mean, that would actually be very popular. drive through temples. Do that with churches as well. I mean, all sorts of stuff. Even drive through funeral services. You know, don't have to get out of the hearse. Anyway. All these ideas come when your mind is very quiet. So you can see just how innovation comes when you're silent. So that's why this type of meditation you're doing here. It's amazing how many ideas you get for your business, for your life, how you learn how to deal with problems in life, how you can have good relationships with people. Because you learn how to have a good relationship with yourself, first of all. You don't expect yourself to be perfect in meditation. You don't have to be perfect in meditation to become enlightened. You just make peace with this. This is good enough. I don't want anything more. You're at peace. You stop. And then the jhanas come to you. So you don't expect your wife to be like Angelina Jolie. You don't expect your husband to be like Brad Pitt. Although there's a couple of... Not Brad Pitt. Bruce Willis. Even though there is a couple of bald guys here. Bruce Willis, he's bald apparently. So eventually, it's not who your husband is or who your wife is. It doesn't matter what you're observing in meditation. It's very much how you're observing it. Gets you enlightened or not. Gets you into jhanas. Gets you into a very beautiful relationship. How are you relating to your partner? Are you making peace, being kind, being gentle? Or you're making, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why were you late? Why were you spending too much? That is a problem. So when you have this beautiful relationship with your own body, your own mind, you open the door of your heart to yourself, as you are, with all your stupid idiosyncrasies, you're at peace with yourself. Then you're in good meditation. If you know how to be at peace with yourself, you know how to be at peace with your partner. You don't try and make them different. You accept them who they are. You accept this moment as it is. This moment is the most important in the world. And the only thing you ever do is be kind to it. You're kind to your husband, you're kind to your wife, you're kind to your kids. You know, that's all your kids really need from you as parents. Kindness. At least I know there's some people in the world who really love them and never criticize them. Their mum and dad. Because everywhere else in the world, they'd always get criticism, always being told off. At school, they'll be never good enough. In life, you know, maybe never pretty enough, never strong enough. But at least at home, you know, the parents can say, you're always good enough, son. Daughter, you're always pretty enough. You don't have to change at all. adore my heart will always, forever be open to you, no matter what you do. And you say that to yourself in your meditation. Meditation for the last 8 or 9 days. You'd be terrible. But never mind. The door of my heart's always open to you, mind. You'll always be my friend. And then you understand what enlightenment is. So that is just summing up this retreat, giving a bit extra. When people say, what is it, how to continue the benefits of the retreat in normal daily lives, this is the normal life. When you go to the abnormal, artificial world outside, whatever you've done here, you'll be able to apply so easily to what goes on in your life outside. So that is how it works. Before I finish off, is there any comments or questions?